Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. It's fantastic to see everybody here. I'm back from Montana and Crescent City and Montana again, and I don't want to travel again in the foreseeable future. I'm enjoying these beautiful days. It's pretty cold right now in Montana, so if there's anybody listening in Montana, I'm really glad I'm here and not there. I tease them, my friends back there, I say, snow is God's way of telling us we're not supposed to live there. Anyway, welcome everybody. So I have in my hand a sign-up sheet for a potluck for Paradox class the day before Christmas, which is a Sunday. So Christmas Eve, we are having class, and our own Dave Sargent is going to teach, and you're going to talk about birds, Dave? Okay, good. If you like animals, if you love the Lord, come and see it. And you're going to be here, Hugh, but you're not going to be teaching. Okay, so potluck, December 24th, Sunday. We'll be eating during class, and hopefully the bird doesn't get loose and grab our food. And after class, there'll be a time of fellowship. So I'm going to put this on the treats table back there, and I hope everybody can make it. And all of you people that are out there in internet land who love to sit around in your pajamas and watch Paradox class, please come at least that day, and come in general. You know, it's a better deal. I saw this the other day. I've seen this several times. When you have a meeting on Zoom, as opposed to a meeting in person, it is physiologically different. There are endorphins that are released when you're in the presence of another human being that add to the excitement and the enjoyment of the social interaction that don't occur when you're meeting on Zoom, in Zoom. So think about that if you don't go to church. Think about that if you don't go to Paradox. Think about that if you're trying to have friendships on Zoom and you don't meet in person. It doesn't work. It's not designed to work. We're designed to be eyeball to eyeball. Anyway, that's my two cents. Hugh's schedule. Hugh is going to be with us all the way through January 14th and the 21st when he'll be gone, but we can enjoy a few weeks of him being here every week. And thank you everybody who does treats back there. It's one of those unsung things that gets done every week. There's something back there to eat and drink, and we're really grateful for everybody that does that. And I want to do a shout out especially to Tim and Jamie and Mark and all the tech people back there who make the class happen and put it online. It's a lot of work. I got here really early this morning, and Mark DeCaro wanders in about 11 o'clock, so that's how early he gets here to set stuff up. So thank you to all of those people that make Paradox happen. And to Val, thank you. The Durhams both. Well, let's say a prayer. And we get the privilege, the unbelievable privilege this morning of having Dr. Hugh Ross with us. Lord Jesus, we are so grateful for all the small things in our life that we take for granted, the beautiful weather that we have here, the safety, the peace, the ability to get in our car and drive around, and especially, Lord, the ability to worship you and know you. Thank you so much for this class, for Paradox class that's meant so much to me for almost 25 years, Dr. Hugh Ross's teaching and friendship and loyalty to this class. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for all the people in this class. We ask your blessing on Dr. Ross's teaching this morning. Please bless us each as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
I think we're, yeah, hold it. Ross, think you need to turn off your microphone. Okay, thank you. All right, appreciate what Ross said about California comparing with Montana. And you know, I like snow. I like to look at it, and that's one of the wonderful things about California. We can be down here close to sea level and look up and see the snow on the mountains around us. And if we want to go up and visit the snow, we can. It's like a half hour away, and you can enjoy all that. And I remember reading online how California is a near paradise, except for the government, the taxes, and the traffic. So, but the truth is, we live on a really beautiful planet. God has given us a great home. This planet Earth is unlike any other planet. That's what we're going to be talking about, is just the special design of the planets in our solar system, planet Earth in particular, the asteroids, the moons in our solar system. But we do live on a really beautiful planet. I mean, we human beings have spoiled it to some degree, but this is a really beautiful planet, and we need to enjoy what God has given to us. And we started this class on design for redemption by making the point, just to get one planet on which life can possibly exist, you need a universe of 2 trillion galaxies, where each galaxy has hundreds of billions of stars. If you have a universe any bit tinier, there's no possibility for a planet in which life can exist. Make it the slightest bit bigger, and likewise, there's no possibility for a planet like Earth on which life can exist. And what we've been doing on this series of Design for Redemption is making the point that everything in the universe is designed not only to make possible a home for us here on planet Earth, to make possible billions of human beings to be redeemed from their sin and evil. And it begins with the universe as a whole. Then we look at the cosmic web, the super galaxy cluster in which we live, our galaxy cluster, our local group, our galaxy. Last week we talked about just how special our star is. I mean, of all the stars in the universe, a trillion stars, we're orbiting the only star on which a planet can have advanced life upon it. And I showed you last week the star that places second to the sun, and the star that comes the closest to matching the characteristics of the sun is simply not a candidate. It's way too unstable, has way too much flaring activity for advanced life and advanced civilization to exist on a planet that's orbiting it. But what I want to speak about this afternoon is what's called the habitable zone, the planetary habitable zone. And if you ever go to the NASA website, or just look at what they have online, you'll hear this constant message that the universe is filled with habitable planets, and how they claim that there's at least 40 billion habitable planets in our Milky Way galaxy alone. Now, that claim is based on the presumption that there's only one planetary habitable zone. And what I'm going to be sharing with you is that there's probably a whole lot, but there's 14 that astronomers have discovered. But all you hear on the popular media, on the internet, on the NASA websites, is the one planetary zone that's the most generous in allowing life to possibly exist. So, what is this planetary habitable zone? It's basically the distance from the host star in which a planet can possibly have life. And the thing about NASA is the one planetary habitable zone they look at is water. And they say, well, that the mantra of NASA is, follow the water and you'll find life. Why? Because liquid water is a fundamental requirement for life, but it's not the only requirement for life. But this is where you get the idea that there's 40 or 45 billion habitable planets in a Milky Way galaxy alone. It's based on the presumption all we need to do is find a planet on which liquid water could conceivably exist on its surface. And, you know, on planet Earth, water is liquid between 0 and 100 degrees centigrade. And so as long as you're at a distance from the host star, where the temperature in the surface is between 0 and 100 degrees, you get the possibility for liquid water. But this assumes that the atmosphere has the right characteristics. So for example, if it wasn't for the atmosphere of a planet Earth, our planet would be way too cold to have liquid water. It's thanks to our atmosphere that a planet is about 33 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it otherwise would be. And so thanks to our atmosphere, our surface of our planet is warm enough that liquid water can exist. But this is where NASA comes up with this generous estimate. They say, well, let's assume that there is no atmosphere. Let's assume there's a very thick atmosphere. And based on how many greenhouse gases you got in the atmosphere, you can have a planet of different temperatures independent of the radiation from the star. And so if you're willing to play around with the atmosphere, you can indeed make the liquid water habitable zone very broad. But let me just give you a preview of the 14 habitable zones that have been discovered so far. And I've been working on this for a couple of decades, and I'm noticing that we astronomers discover a new planetary habitable zone about once every year or two. And so we've been adding to the list. And if you've been following what I've been writing in my books, there was a time that I talked about 3 planetary habitable zones. Then the list went up to 7 planetary habitable zones, then 9, then 10, and today we're looking at 14 known habitable zones. Now, there may be as many as 50 or 100 of these planetary habitable zones. 14 have been discovered so far. So the one that NASA is focused on is the water habitable zone, the liquid water habitable zone. I also refer to it as the temperature habitable zone, that the planet needs to be the appropriate distance from the star where the temperature is within the range in which liquid water can exist. Now, the second habitable zone that was discovered was the ultraviolet habitable zone. And basically what you see here in this list, they're in order of how they were discovered. And so about 15 years ago, the ultraviolet habitable zone was discovered, then the photosynthetic habitable zone, what's called the tropospheric ozone habitable zone, the need to have a certain fine-tuned quantity of ozone in the troposphere of the atmosphere of the planet, the rotation of the planet, the tilt of the rotation axis, the tidal forces that are exerted on the planet's surface, and then not just the atmosphere of the planet, but the atmosphere of the star is a crucial feature. And then whether or not the planet has a measurable atmospheric electric field. What's the voltage of the electric field of the planet? The eccentricity, which is basically just simply describing the shape of the orbit about the star. And the shape of that orbit plays a role, as does what are called the Milankovitch cycles, which is basically the variation, the tilt of the rotation axis of the planet and the shape of its orbit. The most recently discovered ones is that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere must be fine-tuned. The carbon monoxide also must be fine-tuned. And then last of all, the fact that you need a coupled magnetosphere between the moon and the planet. In other words, life is only possible if you've got a planet-moon system where the magnetospheres can couple when the planet-moon system is relatively young. But let me begin by focusing on the one zone that's gotten the most attention, the liquid water habitable zone. Now, where does NASA come up with a number of 40 billion habitable planets in our Milky Way galaxy? It's because they defined liquid water habitable zone so it is extremely broad. And so, and basically what they're doing is they're saying, well, we're going to call it habitable if you can have liquid water existing on the surface of the planet for 3 months or more. And I refer to that as ephemeral water, water that exists for just a very short period of time and on a small surface of the planet. So they're not talking a planet like Earth where you got oceans covering 71% of the planet, where they're kilometers deep. They're basically saying, we'll call it habitable if we have liquid water on, say, a few square kilometers of the surface of the planet, where that liquid water exists, say, for 90 days. And that's the ephemeral liquid water habitable zone. Now, I put this in terms of what I call astronomical units. I don't know how many of you people are familiar with an astronomical unit. You know, I remember we were getting articles written by astronomers that are part of our scholar community, and they would write about these astronomical units, and our editors had to say, wait a minute, most lay readers don't know what an astronomical unit is. And they say, well, everybody's got to know what that is. So astronomers live in a very isolated community, and they have these ideas. Everybody knows what a parsec is. Everybody knows what an astronomical unit is. And an astronomical unit is simply the distance between the sun and the earth. It's 92.7 million miles. And just think of it as the distance between the sun and the earth. But if you're willing to call it habitable, if you have liquid water on a small part of the planet's surface for just a short period of time, what you discover, any planet that's within 0.39 or 2 astronomical units of a star like the sun would have liquid water on its surface. But there are people who realize, hey, if you're really serious about having life on the planet, it doesn't do you any good to have water just sitting there for 90 days on a few square kilometers. You need to have what is called semi-permanent water. And what you discover there is that you get a broader, a narrower habitable zone. But if you want permanent liquid water, say you're interested in having a planet with advanced life on it, and what I mean by advanced life, something more than a single-celled microbe. If all you want are microbes, the conditions are a little more generous. But if you want something beyond just single-celled microbes, you need water existing literally for billions of years on the surface of the planet, at least 2 billion, if not 3 billion years. And that's the bottom feature. And what you notice there is that now we're looking at a very narrow liquid water habitable zone. With respect to the distance of the Earth from the Sun, it's got to be between 99.5% and between 100.5%. So 0.995 astronomical units to 1.005 astronomical units. And so just to give you a picture of this, if you take the NASA definition of a liquid water habitable zone, you see you got a very generous distance ratio from the star where the planet could conceivably be habitable. But if we're talking a planet where you've got semi-permanent liquid water, this is what the liquid water habitable zone looks like. You see that it's significantly narrower. And if you want to have a planet that's got permanent liquid water on it, where the water exists for 3 billion years, that's how narrow the liquid water habitable zone is. And you notice, you got to get really carefully look at the slide even to see that liquid water habitable zone. And so now, instead of having 40 billion habitable planets within a Milky Way galaxy, it reduces down to thousands of planets that are habitable within our Milky Way galaxy. A dramatic drop if you're looking for something that can support something a little more complicated than a few single-celled microbes. Now, the second habitable zone that was discovered is what's called the ultraviolet habitable zone. And I remember when this was first published, people were saying, what does ultraviolet light have to do with life? Well, it turns out there are certain proteins that are crucial for all life to exist that can only be manufactured if there's some exposure to ultraviolet light. So we need to have ultraviolet light radiating on the surface of the planet in order for critical biochemicals, in particular certain proteins, to be manufactured. Now, it's also true if you get too much ultraviolet radiation, that kills the life. I mean, for example, I don't know how many of you have ever been in a hospital where you've had surgery. What I noticed in my last surgery, that they put me on this table and there was nobody around there. They just bathed me in ultraviolet light. because that just kills all the microbes that are there in the room. And they need a certain intensity of ultraviolet light. They also need it to be a short wavelength. And so it's the long wavelength ultraviolet light that's crucial for making these life essential biochemicals. The short ultraviolet light is deadly for life. So you need to fine tune the wavelength, and you need to fine tune the quantity of ultraviolet radiation that comes in to the surface of the Earth. Now, this is significant because, again, if you go to the NASA website or just read web articles on habitable planets, there's a big focus on what they call M-dwarf stars and K-dwarf stars. They make up over 90% of all the stars that exist. And you know, say, where do they come up with these letters? Again, it's astronomers, and again, I run into the astronomers, says everybody knows what an M-dwarf star is. Most people have never heard of it. We are orbiting what's called a G-dwarf star. And so what happens in astronomy, the smallest stars are called M-stars. The next category are called K-type stars. Then there's G-type stars like our sun. Then you got the F-type stars that are more massive than our star, the sun. And then you got the A-type stars that are more massive than the M-stars, the O-type stars, or probably the B-type stars, and the O-stars. Now, say, how do people ever remember this stuff? Well, when I took astronomy, they just gave us a little sentence that said, this will help you remember it. Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me. Oh, be A, F, G, K, and M. But what we now notice is in order to get the ultraviolet radiation that's crucial for life to exist on a planet, only very young F stars and G stars, no older than the sun, qualify. And so now you have this huge range of stars. Once we talk about the ultraviolet habitable zone, it basically narrows in to a very small subcategory of stars that are very close to the mass and the age of the sun. And so when the sun was young, the ultraviolet radiation was so intense it would not permit life to exist. So you can basically eliminate all the young stars. Say young, how young do you mean? Anything younger than a half billion years, the star's ultraviolet radiation puts it, all of its planets, outside of the habitable zone, and explains why you don't see microbes on the Earth until our planet, our solar system, is beyond a half billion years old. Okay, here's the situation. For stars less massive than the sun, you have the ultraviolet habitable zone just as narrow as the liquid water habitable zone, but they don't overlap. For stars less massive than the sun, the ultraviolet habitable zone is inside the liquid water habitable zone. And unless the two zones overlap, you have no possibility for life. And what about stars more massive than the sun? It goes the opposite. The ultraviolet habitable zone is now more distant from the star than the liquid water habitable zone. And so you say, well, of all the stars that exist, is there any possibility that they'll overlap? Well, for 3% of all the stars in our Milky Way galaxy, there's a possibility that they will overlap at some time during the history of the star. But only for stars that are exactly the mass of our star, the sun, will the overlap last billions of years. And so, yes, you'll see in different articles in the ultraviolet habitable zone, for 3% of the stars, they can overlap, but for the vast majority of those 3% of stars, the overlap is highly ephemeral. It only overlaps for a short period of time in the history of the sun. You really need the star to be precisely the mass of our star, the sun, for the two zones to overlap so that life can exist for a long period of time. So suddenly, this 40 billion is now dropping to hundreds. So for our Milky Way galaxy. Now, the third one that was discovered is the photosynthetic habitable zone. And this is brought up because there's a huge difference between photosynthetic life and non-photosynthetic life. And here we're talking about life that produces the energy that it needs for life. So we're not talking animals here. Animals consume plant material. But in terms of life forms that are able to produce the energy they need to drive life, the photosynthetic life forms have a huge advantage in terms of energy that's able to be produced and exploited for the life system compared to non-photosynthetic life. The metabolic rates are between 1,000 to 10 million times greater for photosynthetic life. And so non-photosynthetic, what we basically call photosynthetic life, another term is aerobic life, life that uses oxygen or produces oxygen, and non-aerobic life. So you can give us some examples. Well, there's microbes, for example, that will feed on methane and exploit that methane to generate energy. But the energy that can be exploited is 1,000 times or 10 million times less than what happens for photosynthesis. And here's the bottom line. If you want life that's capable of doing very much, you need to be in what's called the photosynthetic habitable zone. And the point here is that it requires a much narrower ultraviolet habitable. The ultraviolet habitable zone goes from this down to this if you want photosynthetic life. Moreover, that ultraviolet habitable zone must exist with high stability for a long period of time. And again, this is an argument that if you want life on a planet, it needs to be a planet orbiting a star that's the same mass as our planet, as our sun. The tiniest difference in the mass of the star means that it's not going to be in the photosynthetic habitable zone, which means you might have microbes on the planet, but the microbes aren't going to be able to do very much. And if you look at non-aerobic life on planet Earth, they basically exist at a subsistence level. They have a real challenge in trying to reproduce or adapt to their environment, and it's because they have so little energy that they can exploit to repair systems. They're very easily damaged and driven to extinction because there just isn't that much energy that they're able to exploit. Now, some of the factors for the photosynthetic zone. The temperature must be just right. In fact, I've been having a debate on global warming with some climatologists, and they're saying, well, you know what? We could actually get more productivity out of life on planet Earth if we simply boost the carbon dioxide level. You've probably heard this, that if you talk to your plants, they grow faster. That's actually true if you talk to your plants. But you want to get really close to your plants in order to have a positive effect. And it's not the talking, it's the fact that you're breathing out carbon dioxide. And as you breathe out carbon dioxide in your plants, the photosynthetic reaction goes more efficiently. And you get maximum efficiency when the carbon dioxide level reaches about 600 to 650 parts per million. Where are we today? We're at 415 parts per million. And so what we're seeing is that our crops are able to grow more efficiently because we got more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. However, temperature also plays a role. And so one reason why there's some alarm about global warming is that the global mean temperature is already creeping above the optimal level for C3 photosynthesis. You say, I didn't know there's a difference. Yeah, there's C3 photosynthesis and C4 photosynthesis. C3 photosynthesis, the optimal global mean temperature is about 16 degrees centigrade. And we're sitting at about 17, moving up to 18 right now. And so even though the carbon dioxide level is making things better, the fact that we have an increasing temperature is making things worse. Bottom line, you need to have a fine-tuned temperature. Now, with C4 photosynthesis, you can tolerate a higher temperature. You can literally be going up into the 80 degrees Fahrenheit. But here's the problem. C4 photosynthesis only covers 5% of the plants on planet Earth. All the trees are C3 photosynthesis. Crops like rice and wheat, millet, oats, they're all C3 photosynthesis. You say, what about C4? Sugarcane and corn are C4 photosynthesis. And so people have been saying, hey, global warming might be a good thing. We can grow more corn, we can grow more sugarcane, and we can grow it more widely. Because yes, it can tolerate a temperature that's about 5 degrees centigrade warmer than what you get with C3 photosynthesis. The problem though is that with sugarcane and corn, you get lots of calories, but not many nutrients. If you want lots of nutrients, you need C3 photosynthesis. Okay, the planet's rotation rate affects photosynthesis. You say, how does that work? Well, if you have a long rotation rate, then that means it gets really cold at night. And if it gets cold at night, that causes the photosynthesis to go down. And also, you might wind up freezing the plants. And then it's going to be too hot during the daytime. And if you have a fast rotation rate, you now generate more violent storms on the planet, which means that the photosynthetic life has got to grow stronger stalks. This actually happened to my son. He wanted to grow some really hot peppers for his recipes. And so in our living room, he planted these pepper plants. And then he said, Dad, my pepper plants are really spindly. And I said, well, yeah, because they're inside the house. There's no wind. If you want to have strong stalks, because what he's seeing is the plants would produce peppers and the peppers would break off from the plants because they didn't have strong enough stalks and branches. And so he said, you need a fan to blow on these peppers, and that actually stresses the plants enough that they grow stronger stalks and branches. And that's also true out in the wild, that you need to have just the right rotation rate. Too much, and the plant puts all of its energy into growing the stalk and the branches, and very little energy into producing the fruit. But if you have not enough wind, then you got something that's so spindly that the fruit just falls off before it is ripe. Okay, the density and composition of the atmosphere, that determines how much of the radiation from the star that's important for photosynthesis gets through, and the luminosity and the color of the host star. And so one of the wonderful things about our star, the sun, is that it pours out a lot of light at just the right wavelengths for C3 and C4 photosynthesis. And so the brightness of the star and the color of the star are crucial in order to make sure you get that. Okay, so far we've covered three. We've covered the liquid water habitable zone, the ultraviolet habitable zone, and the photosynthetic habitable zone. Here's a trivia question. Out of the 5,600 planets that astronomers have discovered outside of our solar system, how many of them live in even just those three habitable zones?
None.
The answer is zero, yeah. And our star, the sun, is the only one, our planet Earth is the only one that lives in even these three habitable zones. Now, we have found some planets that are candidates to live in two of these habitable zones, but once again, for a planet to be truly habitable, it must be orbiting in all the known planetary habitable zones. Let me cover one more before we go to Q&A, and that's the tropospheric ozone habitable zone. Now, you need to have, okay, it's radiation from the sun, ultraviolet radiation, coming into the planet's atmosphere, and it transforms some of that oxygen to ozone. And so one of the things that astronomers do trying to determine, is there oxygen in some distant planet orbiting another star? We look for ozone. If we see ozone in the spectrum of that planet, then we know there must be oxygen on the surface of the planet. Now, oxygen and ozone are not true biomarkers. There's ways of getting oxygen and ozone without life. But if you want life on the planet, you need ozone to be at a certain level within the troposphere. So what do I mean by the troposphere? It's the layer of the atmosphere that's closest to the surface of the Earth. It's basically the layer where rain clouds form. So in the case of our planet, we're basically looking at about the first 15,000 to 20,000 feet, or maybe even less, say the first 10,000 feet above the surface of the Earth is where you're going to get these rain clouds forming. And we need ozone to be present at that level, because if you got life on the planet and you got no ozone in the troposphere, biochemical smog will build up to a level that basically exterminates all life. And so if you actually go into some parts of the United States, you can actually see where this biochemical smog builds up. I mean, a good example would be the San Joaquin Valley here in California, where you see a huge buildup of this smog, and the smog is being emitted by the trees. I mean, there's a lot of orchards in the San Joaquin Valley, and trees do produce smog. So it's not just your automobiles, plants, and especially trees produce smog. What controls that is ozone. It's ozone that pulls that biochemical smog out of the atmosphere. But if you've got too much ozone in the troposphere, that causes respiratory failure. You say, well, that would be just for the animals, right? Well, it turns out plants also respire. And so all life will take in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. The thing about photosynthetic plants is that it does the photosynthesis to a higher degree than it does the respiration. But all life to exist does respire. All life is respiring, plants and animals. And so at night, you got the plants predominantly, they're not doing photosynthesis at night because there's no sunlight, and so they're respiring. However, if you got too much ozone in the troposphere, that basically kills the plants and kills the animals. Now you say, which species is most sensitive to that? We human beings. We are especially sensitive to ozone in the atmosphere. And incidentally, it's also true that carbon dioxide affects our respiration. So people have been saying, well, you know, 415 parts of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, that's actually allowing us to grow more crops. But when you start getting above about 450 parts per million, you now begin to see an increase in incidence of respiratory problems for human beings. And it becomes quite noticeable at 600 parts. At 900 parts, you got people going to the hospital and even people are dying. And so too much carbon dioxide is a problem. We'll be getting to that. We talk about the carbon dioxide habitable zone. But ozone is crucial. The ozone has to be at a just right level. You need it to be abundant enough that it prevents the buildup of biochemical smog, but low enough that you don't get respiratory failure in plants and animals. Okay, I'll stop at that point and take questions. We'll finish the rest of this up next week, get through the other 10 habitable zones. But the bottom line, of all the habitable planets we see out there, there's only one that exists in all 14 habitable zones. Only stars identical to the Sun and planets that are identical to planet Earth in terms of their distance from the Sun do these four zones that we just covered overlap. Then the others make it even more constraining again. Okay, we'll take questions from people here in person. And by the way, I love what you said about the benefit of being here in person. There's something that happens, even in terms of the hormones that flow within our body, when we do have face-to-face contact with human beings. And hey, when we have that potluck, maybe one thing we can do is turn the cameras onto the food that we're eating, right? So, because I notice people participating virtually, they tell me that the virtual food just doesn't taste as good as the real food. So maybe we can tempt them a little bit with that approach. Assuming we bring good stuff for the potluck, right? Okay. So, but you know, one thing too I've written on is the fact that we are the only mammalian species where we can eat and talk and socialize and think at the same time. If you look at other large mammals, what they're doing, when they eat, they stop everything to eat, and all their energy is focused on eating. If you look at, say, chimpanzees, they spend 4.5 hours per day eating their food. And when they eat their food, they're isolated from the other chimpanzees. We humans, we can get all the calories we need. Some humans actually get all the calories they need in just 7 minutes a day. For me, it's a little longer than 7 minutes, but the longest is 75 minutes. 75 minutes of eating your food. Now, our meal times tend to be longer than that. Why? We don't spend all of our meal times eating our food. We talk to one another. We socialize with one another. Or we're on our laptop and working on our laptop. I mean, that's one of the amazing things of humans. We can actually have lunch and work at the same time. How many of you have ever had a working lunch meeting? Okay, we all have, right? All have had working lunch meetings. We have an anatomy that permits that. And we have an anatomy that allows us to have fun and socialize while we eat. And so I'm glad that we're actually bringing that into the paradoxes class. Okay, do we have a question from the people online, or you got one in person?
We're going to start with one in person, one of our favorite people who's usually online but is here, and that's Doug. So Doug, come on up, and we'll take turns. We'll do one in person and then one from the internet. So Doug? Yeah, but you got to come on up so the camera can get your beautiful face.
Oh, boy. Yeah, a little closer. Okay, we breathe on each other too, right? So it's beneficial when we eat together. When I breathe on my plants, they die because of my bad breath. I would say that. But you know what? I'm going to default to my good friend, Dave Sargent, and let him go first. Because I love this guy. This guy's great.
Well, thank you. I want to add also, if you're online, the other thing you can't do is pet my bird after class. So I'm bringing my bird that I hand-raised, and after class, if you've never petted a bird, my bird loves to be pet. If you've never petted a feather, you know, that's an experience that you'll love. So do come on that day, and after class, if you like to, well, you can pet my bird. Hugh, my question is actually the slide that you have up there. You talked about too little ozone for smog buildup, and I was surprised because I thought it was going to be about ultraviolet light. I have friends and acquaintances in Australia, and they are quite concerned because our ozone layer has been thinning. And down in Australia, I have a friend that lives down in the southern part of Australia, and he says down there, if you're outside for 15 minutes without sun protection, you get a really nasty sunburn. So the people in southern Australia have to do that. So is that really kind of should be kind of below the smog buildup also?
Hey, your friends in Australia are referring to stratospheric ozone. Ozone in the stratosphere blocks out the short wavelength ultraviolet radiation from the sun. So yes, we've been putting chemicals into the stratosphere that basically thin out the ozone in the stratosphere. When that happens, you get more short wavelength ultraviolet radiation coming down to the surface of the earth, and that's what gives you a bad sunburn. It's also what limits crop productivity. So our crops also get sunburned, and so they don't grow as well. And so it's important that we also ensure that we have the quantity of ozone in the stratosphere that blocks out that dangerous ultraviolet radiation. What I'm talking about here is ozone in the troposphere. And so we have to fine-tune the ozone quantity in the stratosphere. We also have to fine-tune the quantity of ozone in the troposphere. And in both cases, that requires a special kind of star to get the ozone in both the stratosphere and the troposphere at just the right levels. But they are independent of one another. The quantity that you need in the stratosphere is different from the quantity you need in the troposphere. And it's not just the quantity, it's the wavelength of both of them. So yeah, the troposphere is a different matter. So what gives us sunburn is what's happening in the stratosphere.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hugh. We've got great questions online. I'm going to read first a comment by Esther Hollis, and you can comment on it if you want. But she says, my husband says that our star is perfectly designed for ham radio signals with exceptional reception during solar flares. The solar cycle is anticipated to be a good one. And then Valerie Durham right here says, most exoplanets are reported to be in the habitable zone orbit of red dwarf stars. Can microbial life exist there? What about advanced life like mammals?
Good question, and let me just take you back here to the ultraviolet habitable zone. And notice that M dwarf stars, these are the smallest mass stars, basically stars that are between 8% of the mass of the sun and about 55% of the mass of the sun, that none of them through the ultraviolet habitable zone and the liquid water habitable zone overlap. I just put up an article, about a 3,000 word article, up on the reasons.org website. I think it got posted either this past Monday or the Monday before. Basically, I think it was two Mondays ago, basically making the point that we now have multiple independent reasons why life cannot exist on a planet orbiting an M-type star. And for that matter, K-type stars, which are the next mass level up. That covers stars that are between 55% of the mass of the sun and about 85% of the mass of the sun. They're not candidates either. For the simple reason, you're not going to get the ultraviolet and the liquid water habitable zones overlapping. But if you want to go to that article that's up at reasons.org, I give you about a dozen independent reasons why life on a planet orbiting an M dwarf star is not possible. And the reason why I was motivated to do that is because there's so much in the scientific literature, as well as on the website and especially in NASA site, saying M dwarf stars are the place to go. There's multiple reasons why M dwarf stars are impossible candidates for life. We'll be getting into what's called the tidal orbital zone. And the problem with planets that are orbiting smaller mass stars, to be in the liquid water habitable zone, they have to orbit closer to the star. And if you orbit closer to the star, the planet becomes tidally locked. And so we'll be talking about the problem of tidal locking. And so if you look at Mercury and Venus, they're both suffering from tidal locking with the sun. They're so close to the sun that their rotation period becomes roughly equal to their revolutionary period, which means it's blistering hot on one side of the planet and freezing cold on the opposite for long periods of time. I'll be talking about several problems about the tidal habitable zone. But that's just two. There's another 10 or so you'll find in that article that got posted two Mondays ago under my article series called Today's New Reason to Believe. Okay, we'll take the next question. Yeah, you're good.
It's on?
Okay. Yeah, I kind of understand, I think, the big picture you're presenting to us, that there's design, intelligent design, there's beauty, there's uniqueness. So I'm kind of wondering if we're exploring just the Milky Way primarily because it's so much closer than other galaxies because we're in it. And if we did discover life, it wouldn't really conflict with the Bible, would it? It just kind of show that God, I mean, we are unique in that we're created in God's image and stuff, but I've never run across a scripture that says that there, you know, can't be intelligent life elsewhere. I mean, we have the angels, of course, in the other dimension, we think, but I don't think it would destroy my faith if they found something like that. It seems like it's such a big deal for some people. Not so much with you, but like with other non-Christians, they always want to talk about this, about, you know, aliens and spaceships, because it seems to give them an out from considering Christianity, and I don't understand why that would ever exclude someone from believing the Bible. That's my question. Thank you.
Yeah, good question. And I've actually written an article on that too, because you're right. A lot of non-Christians think that if we find life on another planet in our galaxy or anywhere else in the universe, that would prove the Christian faith wrong. And Doug, you're correct. There's nothing in the Bible that would forbid God creating life on another planet. Core to the Christian faith is that if life exists, it exists because God specially created it. But there's nothing in the Bible that says that God couldn't have done it on other planets. And we actually look into Christian literature. For 2,000 years, Christian theologians have debated the question, does life exist elsewhere beyond Earth, or is Earth the only place? And it's basically focusing on, okay, has God only created life on the Earth, or has he created life in multiple other places? And what you'll see in this literature is that the only constraint you can appeal to in the Bible is Hebrews 9 and 10. In Hebrews 9 and 10, it tells us that the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, died one time, one place, to atone for the sins of all who need to be atoned. And so people have looked at that and said, well, it seems to forbid the fact that there would be intelligent life elsewhere like us that's in need of being redeemed from their sin and evil. On the other hand, if they're as advanced as us, they might have television sets and receivers, and maybe they could watch what's going on. And so you can't even rule out the possibility that there could be advanced species like us with the civilization and technology that we have, because the sacrifice of Christ on the cross on planet Earth could conceivably atone even for people, humans like ourselves, on some other planet. And so Christians have been debating this literally for 2,000 years. And the debate is basically theological. Is God so enjoying creation that he wouldn't stop at one planet? And theologians that take that path basically say, look at Psalm 104. It's God extolling and telling us how he's created life in great abundance and great diversity all over the earth. And it seems like God really enjoys creating. And therefore, given how much he enjoys it, why would he stop at one planet? But there are other theologians who argue, when you look at the Gospels, you notice that Jesus conserves his miracles. And what they mean by that, Jesus only performed the miracles that were necessary to achieve the purpose for his coming here on earth. And so what you see in the Gospels, there's multiple times where Jesus says he's asked to perform a miracle and he refuses to perform the miracle. And so it seems like God limits his miracles to that which is necessary to fulfill his redemptive purpose. His purpose in creating the universe to be a stage where billions of humans can be redeemed from their sin and evil. And these theologians would argue, in that context, God only needs to do it on one planet. And so they take the position, life is unique to planet Earth. Other theologians, citing Psalm 104, says, no, there's going to be life everywhere. Where astronomers weigh in, they say, well, wait a minute. Everywhere we've looked beyond planet Earth, we only see conditions that are hostile for life, and in terms of more advanced life, extremely hostile for life. And in a couple of my books, I cite Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an atheist astrophysicist, but in one famous television outtake, he made the comment, the universe is out to kill us. At every opportunity, it's trying to put us to death. And basically making the point, once you get outside of planet Earth, the universe is an incredibly deadly place. And he's correct. Everywhere we have astronomers have looked beyond planet Earth, we only see conditions that are hostile. Have we looked everywhere we could possibly look? No. But we've done a fairly thorough search in our Milky Way galaxy. And we don't see any other galaxies that are candidates for advanced life. And so within our Milky Way galaxy, it seems like we're orbiting the only star, and we're on the one planet orbiting that star where advanced life is even conceivable. So in that context, it seems like we're alone, but we haven't looked everywhere. But everywhere we look, and we've done a fairly exhaustive search. And by the way, your comment about have we actually looked at stars and planets and other galaxies? The truth is, we have. Astronomers now have the capability of detecting planets in other galaxies, relatively nearby galaxies, galaxies like the Andromeda Nebula, galaxies like the Large Magellanic Cloud. And we do it through what's called microlensing, where we will look at a star that's in a distant galaxy, where the light of that star and the planet orbiting that star gets magnified by a star in between. Einstein's theory of general relativity. If you've got a massive body, light that passes by that body will be curved. It will be lensed. And so we're actually able to build super telescopes by looking at what we call natural gravitational lenses. Now, in that case, the star has to be precisely between our line of sight and the star that's got a planet orbiting it. But that's actually been done to detect planets orbiting stars in the Andromeda Galaxy. So yeah, we're able to go more broadly than just our galaxy. Next question.
You online, Robert Gibson has a question. He says, can we use bioengineering to introduce a C4 photosynthetic pathway to nutritious plants that we can eat? Or does epigenetics make bioengineering of C4 plants too complicated?
That's a good question, because people have been saying, well, yeah, we're now warming the planet. We're really putting C3 photosynthesis at risk. Maybe we can bioengineer crops like wheat and rice and oats so that they will produce by C4 photosynthesis. But there are people who have responded to that and say, well, wait a minute. With C4 photosynthesis, you get lots of energy, but not much nutrients, and maybe that wouldn't be a good thing to do. And so people have been toying with the idea of bioengineering the photosynthesis, and people are saying, maybe we can come up with a new photosynthetic pathway that we could call C5 that we bioengineer and able to get plants to do things they can't do right now. These are proposed in the scientific literature. No one has yet achieved it. So, but it's something that's possible. And while it's also possible, and this is actually more feasible, is they've been saying, you know, maybe we can get photosynthesis to work where we don't need plants. So basically making in the lab some artificial device that takes energy from the sun and turns it into sugar and starches and proteins. So doing it independent of plants. It's a, you know, it's the technology is in hand to do that, but no one has yet pulled it off. The one thing that has been successfully done is that they're now able to make lab meat. You say, what's lab meat? It's where they actually artificially grow meat in the lab. And they can make the meat healthier. They can make it taste better. And this is actually on the market. The problem is you got to pay a lot of money to get a lab steak or a lab hamburger. But there's actually the potential. My colleague Faisal Rana has written about this, where maybe a decade from now, we'll be able to grow meat in the lab that'll be cheaper and healthier than meat that we can buy in the store. And therefore, we'll no longer need to have farms where we got chickens and cows and sheep and goats. We can all get all the meat we want by just growing it in the lab.
How does it taste?
It tastes really good. I mean, you cannot tell the difference. In fact, they claim that they can make lab steak that tastes better than the best steak that you can buy in a restaurant. And so they're... What they like about this lab meat is they can engineer it in different ways to make it healthier to eat, where they have the fat content that they want to get the flavors they want. They can play around with that. The problem is that the price right now runs between $15 a pound and $20,000 a pound. So a little bit expensive. But as Fuzz has pointed out, we actually have the potential of making lab meat cheaper than any meat you can buy in a meat market right now. Get it down to, say, $1 a pound. In which case, we could basically, and people have been proposing, this is a way to reduce our dependence on cows. Because cows pump a lot of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. They take up a lot of pasture land that we could put to better use and say we can eliminate our dependency on cows. We could even eliminate our dependency on chickens and turkeys and on sheep just by going with artificial lab meat. But to get the price down where it's going to be economic, we're a good decade away from doing that.
Hi, Dr. Ross. I don't know where this came to my mind, what you were talking about, but I think you've talked about anaerobic bacteria somewhere. And I know, like, you know, if it's sulfuric or sulfide bacteria are anaerobic, but is cyanobacteria and nitrifying bacteria also anaerobic bacteria?
Okay, cyanobacteria are photosynthetic bacteria.
Okay.
So that's another term for photosynthetic bacteria.
Okay.
All cyanobacteria are photosynthetic.
Okay. And nitrifying bacteria? Like in aquariums, there's certain bacteria that
that's
break down the nitrates and nitrites.
That's also photosynthetic life.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
But as you mentioned, there's life forms that get their energy from methane and sulfur products. Those are anaerobic. But as I mentioned here, the efficiency with which anaerobic life can draw energy from its environment and put it for useful work within the cell, literally at least 1,000 times less than what you get with photosynthetic life.
Hugh, David Siri online says, do you think the current population of Israel is sufficiently high enough to allow end times prophecies to occur?
Good question, and it's answered in the book of Ezekiel, which is basically making the point that a time will come when all the Jews, or virtually all the Jews living in the world, will be living in the land of Israel. And we're beginning to see the fulfillment of that prophecy, because when Israel was formed as a nation in 1948, they had a little more than 500,000 Jews living there, compared with over 3 million Jews living in New York City. But today, half of all the Jews in the world are living in the land of Israel. So it's gone from just, I mean, there were like 15 million Jews in 1948, and just 600,000 of them are living in Israel. And now there's about 16, 17 million Jews in the world, and half of those Jews are living in the land of Israel. But for the prophecy in Ezekiel to be fulfilled, all the Jews in the world will be need to be living in the land of Israel. And the same passage in Ezekiel says that's also a time when Israel will become the richest nation. And I would define that as the richest nation per capita on planet Earth. And the wealth of Israel has been increasing, but one thing that limits the wealth of Israel is all the money they have to invest in their military. And so what you also see in Ezekiel is that a time will come when the nation of Israel will disarm, or at least visibly disarm. And when they do that, that's going to release a huge amount of money into their economy, and it's that that's going to make Israel the richest nation on a per capita basis. Right now it's not there because so many of the income of Israel goes to support its military. But as far as the end times clock beginning to tick, it can't happen until Israel is without visible arms. All or nearly all the Jews in the world are living in the land of Israel. I mean, I say nearly all because I imagine they're still going to keep their embassies open. So there's going to be Jews in other nations around the world. But virtually the entire Jewish population will be living in the land of Israel, and they'll have a standard of living that'll be the highest in the world. So until all that happens, the end times clock can't begin to tick. But hey, we're a lot closer to that happening than we were 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when I first taught on this in the paradoxes class. And if you're not aware of it, there's a set of MP3s at paradoxes.org that you can download from the 7-year, 9-month class we taught on the Book of Revelation, affectionately known as the Great Tribulation. Okay.
So I have a question from left field, where my wife, who is from Canada, where she resides, I'm asking for her. It's regarding common conspiracy theory. You're familiar with websites like Geoengineering Watch and so on, and claims that there are chemtrails. Governments are intentionally spraying chemicals out of airplanes, and not merely for seeding clouds and that sort of thing that we know about, but for possibly nefarious purposes. I'd just like to hear your opinion about those claims. I don't recall you ever talking about that in public.
Well, for example, at Harvard University, there's research going on about actually seeding our atmosphere with sulfur aerosols that will block out the light of the sun to a sufficient degree that it would counterbalance global warming. And so that proposal is out there. As far as I know, no one has actually attempted to do that. But there's actually a proposal from these Harvard people to do a test, actually do a small-scale test of pumping these things into the stratosphere and seeing if that would be a viable solution to global warming. I wrote about this in my book on weathering climate change, saying, yes, that would be a means for cooling the planet, but not a recommended means, because you can't control it. If you put a bunch of sulfur aerosols in the atmosphere, what happens if you've got a major volcanic reaction that pumps a lot more of those sulfur aerosols in there? And now you got the planet too cool, and you can't really pull those sulfur aerosols out easily. Now, however, the people in Harvard are saying, we're going to put stuff in the atmosphere that temporarily cools a planet. So this would be equivalent to a regulator. Basically, have something with a half-life of, say, 1 year, and so you pump these into the stratosphere, and if you say, wait a minute, we're getting unintended consequences, hey, a year from now, all that stuff falls out of the atmosphere. So that's one thing about the tests. They want to see, is it realistic to have a short-term effect, which means we just simply pump it into the atmosphere every year at a particular... So it's a way of getting a rheostat, where you control the amount that's in the stratosphere. But nobody knows if it really will work. We don't know if the half-life's going to be 1 year or 50 years. Or 10 years. And so, but that's why they're saying, let's test it and see what's feasible and what's not feasible. I'm arguing in weathering climate change, there's other ways of restabilizing the climate and reducing global warming where we don't have these mysterious unintended consequences. So, but, that's kind of one way, kind of what I call a gross way, a brute force way of trying to rectify global warming. Just pump stuff in the atmosphere that cools the planet.
Perhaps you talk about this in your book, but I believe that the inverse of that experiment is already being conducted because fuel for international shipping is regulated, and they've removed the sulfur from those shipping fuels, which means there's less sulfur aerosol in the air than there used to be. Do you discuss that, or are there any preliminary
results? Well, you mentioned contrails. So, for example, when you got big aircraft flying in the stratosphere, their exhaust will have sulfur particles in it that actually works to cool the atmosphere. And so part of what I discuss in weathering climate change is a contrail effect. So, for example, if you go back about 30 years, 40 years, we had the Concorde supersonic transport. And one of the reasons why they decided to terminate that is because Those things fly at high elevations, usually 40 to 50,000 feet. And because of how fast they're moving, they pour out a lot of this, aerosols that work to cool the atmosphere. And they said, hey, we got to watch out for that. There's now a new effort to restart supersonic air travel. But this new effort is basically using high technology so that these aircraft fly without bad sonic booms. They're going to design the aircraft so that the sonic booms are largely mitigated, and also where they don't really throw out a lot of particulate matter or sulfur. By using specialized fuels, they would minimize the contrail effect. So we'll see.
Hugh, Vance Nordman says, the Planetary Society website says, Mars, which is too far from the sun to be in the habitable zone, once had flowing liquid water. But then why do scientists think Mars once had life?
Scientists will speculate and say Mars must have had life because it was warm and wet 4 billion years ago. That's based on the assumption that the only habitability requirement is that you've got liquid water. That's mainly what I'm going to be doing, try to do today, and I'll do more next week, is basically say liquid water is not sufficient. There are 14 other planetary habitable zones, 13 other planetary habitable zones that also must be met. And Mars certainly doesn't orbit in all 14 habitable zones and never has. And what happened to Mars is that it suffered what's called a carbonate catastrophe. Yes, if you go back 4 billion years, the planet had a thick atmosphere, lots of carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide trapped heat from the sun and made the surface of Mars warm enough that you could have liquid water. The problem is that water chemically combined with carbon dioxide to make carbonates. And because Mars didn't have really aggressive, strong plate tectonic activity, those carbonates could not be recycled back to the atmosphere. On planet Earth, there is no carbonate catastrophe because, yes, water vapor and carbon dioxide chemically react to make the carbonates, but these carbonates are returned to the atmosphere because of the aggressive long-term plate tectonics. Case of Mars, that didn't happen, and once all that carbon dioxide and water got converted into carbonates, the planet went very quickly cold and dry, and has been cold and dry for the last 4 billion years. And so the problem is with Mars, that liquid water and that carbon dioxide doesn't hang around long enough for life to possibly exist. The carbonate catastrophe quickly takes that water and carbon dioxide and puts it into carbonates. And there's other problems with Mars. It's got too much sulfur. It's got 60 times as much sulfur as we see in the crust of the Earth. That quantity of sulfur eliminates the possibility for life on Mars. Now, having said all that, NASA is committed that they're going to find the remains of life on Mars. And I've been on record now for 35 years, they will be successful. They will find the remains of life on Mars. It's not going to be indigenous Martian life, though. It's going to be Earth-transported life. Every time big meteors strike the Earth, it causes Earth's soil to be exported throughout the solar system. And friends of mine have actually calculated how much Earth material is on the surface of Mars today. And it's about, 200 kilograms per square kilometer, the Martian surface. That sounds like a lot, but when you spread it over a whole square kilometer, it's a very, very thin layer. So it's going to be difficult for NASA or the Chinese Space Agency to find the remains of Earth life on Mars, but it is there. And inevitably, they will find it. It's going to be much easier to find on the moon, because there's 20,000 kilograms of Earth soil for every square kilometer of the moon's surface. So, and I spoke at NASA Houston in 2007, basically saying, let's go back to the moon and find the remains of Earth life. Because the moon actually will have a repository of the first life that God created on planet Earth. Those fossils will never be found on Earth because our geology has destroyed them, but they'll be there in pristine form on the moon. We can go to the moon and see who got the origin of life model right, the atheists or the theists. And I closed my talk off at NASA Houston saying, I think you're going to get taxpayer support, because the last time I checked, 100% of the U.S. taxpayer base is made up of atheists and theists.
Hugh, we're out of time. As always, it goes by so quickly. Thank you. Would you please close us in prayer?
Father in heaven, once again, we all want to thank you for this incredibly beautiful and bountiful and productive planet, planet Earth, that you created for us. Thank you that you designed it in such a way that billions of us can live on this planet at one time and enjoy a quality of life that is just incredible. Thank you for being such a generous God. And thank you also for giving us the capability just to see how generous you are and how exquisitely you have designed our planet, our solar system, everything in the universe, so that we can enjoy life here on planet Earth. And Father, we also just want to thank you for revealing multiple purposes for why you made the universe the way it is. And Father in heaven, I pray that each of us as a human being would do everything we can to fulfill the purpose for why you created us. And we thank you too that you created each one of us with a different mission, a different purpose to fulfill. Help us to discover that, help us to fulfill it, help us to be a blessing unto one another and a blessing unto you especially. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.